On Insight Today, the new chair of California's Republican Party, Jessica Patterson, sits down with our Capitol Bureau chief, Ben Adler. She talks about rebuilding the party in one of the bluest states. She's the first woman and the first Latina in that role, and she wants the state GOP to become a bigger tent. Temple University's Kathy Hirsch-Pasek studies language acquisition. I spoke with her in December about her research on how apps, devices, and TV influenced childhood language development. And we preview our Tiny Desk Sacramento Showcase. Hey Listen host Nick Bruner curates a list of local highlights with help from musician Lillian Francis and producer Camille Escovedo. They look ahead to Cap Radio's music celebration on June 1st. We'll get you all of the details so you won't miss out. I'm Randall White. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. Earlier this year, the California Republican Party picked a new chair. Jessica Patterson is the first woman and first Latina to lead the state GOP. Cap Radio's Ben Adler caught up with Patterson yesterday at the Capitol to find out about her vision for the future of the party in the Golden State. Jessica Patterson acknowledged the challenges ahead for her party.
Well, certainly, I was not blinded to the challenges that would come with being the chairman of the California Republican Party. And so we also knew that we had to come in with a plan to energize people. And when you say tired of it, I think a lot of people are tired of it. And they're tired of one-party rule. And they're tired of the failed policies of Democrats that have been coming out of Sacramento. So we've put together four ad hoc committees that are focused on really rebuilding our party. Two of them are big picture strategy, and then two of them are more tactical. So on the big picture strategy side of things, we have a huge focus on fundraising. Without fundraising, we won't have the resources to do all of the other things that we want to do. And then another big picture strategy is our media and messaging. There are a lot of communities that have felt neglected by Republicans over the years. And so we're doing a really aggressive approach on engaging in communities that have felt neglected by us. We're making sure that we're utilizing the proper vehicles to move messages into those communities.
Vehicles like what? What do you mean?
So, for example, someone my age, not me specifically, because I'm a nerd that reads every piece of political mail that comes to my house, but for someone my age, catching me in my mailbox is not necessarily the most effective way to get a message in front of me. You want to get a message in front of me, catch me in my Instagram feed. And so not only is the mail not effective in not getting the message in front of me, but it's also one of the most expensive ways to get a message in front of me. So you're going to see us utilizing a lot more of our digital resources. We're also going to be utilizing new messengers within communities to deliver those messages as well.
And of course, it's inescapable that you're the first female and the first Latina to run the California Republican Party. There was this image at the convention, which, for better or for worse, was played all over the place with all of the male state party chairs on Friday night. And then it ended with a very different image of you and your husband and your two young daughters up on the stage at the end. For folks who don't know about you, introduce yourself and explain why you believe in the Republican Party.
So, first of all, I'd say that our board as a whole, our 23 board members, is an incredibly diverse board. When you walk into one of my board meetings, half of the board members are women. We have four Latinos on our board. We've got two openly gay men. We've got a Taiwanese immigrant as our vice chair. And so it is a fantastic thing to see. And not because any of us ran on being the first anything. We all ran on the issues that we believed were important to the delegates and the vision that we had for our party going forward. So the fact that the media and others are taking notice of this beautiful, diverse board that is a great reflection of California is a good thing for our party, and it's a good thing for our brand. Now, I myself grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles, a city called Hacienda Heights, and I spent most of my childhood in Hacienda Heights, moved to Montebello just outside of East LA when I was in high school. And that was really when I had my first dip into politics. And I later interned for an assembly member and interned at the state party. And I've worked a career in politics over the last 15 years and met my husband, Wes, in college. And we have two beautiful little girls who are a ton of fun. And we're just out there trying to have the American dream. We want good schools for our kids. We want safe streets. We want to be, you know, just like everybody else, have a good home and be able to watch our kids and eventually our grandkids grow up in California, because this is our home. And right now, with the one-party rule, it's making it very, very difficult for people to stay here.
It is one-party rule. It's also in part a rejection of your party, and one that preceded President Trump, although some would say that he's accelerated that trend. How do you turn that around? And is it just messaging and the vehicle, or is it the policy views too?
I think for certain we need to make sure that we have alternatives. I don't think it's enough being the opposition party and just being a party of no. It is incredibly important that we understand that at the end of the day, people have real problems. They have real problems that they want solutions to. And if we want to be successful, we need to engage in these places where that message hasn't come for a long time. We need to make sure we're delivering it, and we need to talk to people about real problems. What we can see is that the policies that are coming out of Sacramento are failing, and they're failing some of our most vulnerable communities. And when you see a study that says 53% of Californians believe they're going to have to leave the state because it's become so unaffordable, to me, that's pretty clear. We need to try something different.
That also sounds like the message of Republican John Cox, who ran for governor against Gavin Newsom last year and got beat pretty soundly. I mean, he was talking about affordability. He was trying very hard not to talk about President Trump. He was trying hard not to talk about social issues and whatever hot button issues might be popping up in D.C. He really did want to talk about poverty in California and housing and the gas tax and pocketbook issues. And he still lost pretty big.
And I think that things have only gotten worse since then. And I think that California is really at a tipping point. And we have the opportunity right now. If we come together in a united way with a good message and good policies and we run on those, I think we can be successful.
We're talking with California Republican Party Chairwoman Jessica Patterson on CAP Radio. What do you say to a middle-of-the-road California voter, maybe has voted for folks in both parties, who say, look, you know, I'm not necessarily all the way there with Democrats on a lot of things, but I can't get past President Trump right now? We know there's a lot of those Californians, according to polls.
I think that right now what we see is people aren't leaving our country. People are leaving our state. And so I think you have to be able to differentiate on candidates across the board. And right now, the failed policies of California Democrats are affecting us more on a daily basis.
Does that mean that a voter like that ought to consider splitting their ticket? Voting maybe Democratic at the national level and Republican at the state level?
I think that there's a lot of California voters. We see it a lot with, you know, the increase and decline to states where they do that.
What about California Republicans who aren't comfortable with the president? But, you know, we saw, you know, anecdotally, of course, but the results of the 2018 congressional races compared to 2016 seem to suggest, and you may have better data on this than many others, that there were a segment of those voters who either stayed home or voted for a Democrat for Congress.
Certainly in 2016, we saw many of our congressional members, all of which, you know, we had won in 2016, won in Hillary districts. And so we really need to focus this cycle on making sure that we are running super localized campaigns. We're talking about issues that are important to Californians and issues that are going to affect them on a daily basis.
We always hear that, right? We always hear whenever one party is struggling to counteract the national message, we always hear all politics is local. And yet it's been a while since that's worked.
It's certainly when you're outspent by $100 million, it certainly is difficult to get that message out there. And so what we really need to focus on at the party level is to make sure we're making that gap as small as it possibly can be between what we're raising and they're raising. And then we spend our dollars in the most effective and efficient way. because we know we're going to be outraised and we know we're going to be outspent. We have to make sure that if we are delivering our message in the most effective way and the most efficient use of our dollars, that it'll get down into those communities, plus the empowerment of the grassroots. And I think that right now, California is really at a tipping point, and we have an opportunity, but we have to make sure that we are there and we are engaging and we're showing up.
What to you would be helpful coming out of Washington? I mean, there's a lot of talk about immigration. Right now, there's a lot of talk about abortion. Neither of those issues are issues that I suspect are going to make a majority of Californians vote for Republicans. Are those issues, if a voter comes to you on either of those issues, what do you say?
I think certainly that we would all love to see comprehensive immigration reform come through. And it's very clear that Democrats do not want to be at the table when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform. A year and a half ago, they were ready to shut down the government over DACA. And President Trump came back with a DACA fix, and Democrats refused to come to the table on it. So I think that is actually someplace where we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity about talking about solutions, because I think people really do want solutions. And here in California, the California Republican Party is a pro-life party. And I think that you see candidates that are across the spectrum when it comes to that. And for me, as a state party chair, I'm a big tent Republican, and I want every person that identifies as a Republican to feel comfortable within our party. And we all have to do a better job of being ambassadors to the party, engaging with people, and making them feel welcome in our party.
Finally, in about a week's time, 15 or so Democratic presidential candidates are coming to San Francisco for the state party convention. I would imagine that on one level, as a Californian, you're excited to see the state have some influence. I'm curious what you think about whether California, with its strong Democratic majority, if some of the policies that Democrats are pushing for at the state capitol, what effect do you think those policies might be having on the presidential race, if it is affecting the candidates for president on the Democratic side?
Oh, I think it absolutely is. And I'm very, very happy and excited about that, because I think that the more we see more candidates get in, the more we see three freshman members that are running the Democratic Party nationally, you're going to see candidates that are pushed further and further to an agenda that is not consistent with even California, I believe, but the overall country. And so I think that it is a good thing for my party when we have so many of these candidates that are moving so far to the socialist side of things.
The socialist side, and define, what do you mean by socialist? That's a buzzword that can be defined many different ways.
Yeah, well, I think that we're really looking at the difference between choice and control. And the more that we see these activists and different party leaders push to the left, it's about government control in your life.
All right. California Republican Party Chairwoman Jessica Patterson, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was California's new chair of the state Republican Party, Jessica Patterson, speaking with Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. There's more news at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. The way human beings learn language from each other is a rich and complicated field of science. The assumptions and myths older generations grew up with are being challenged and overturned by new research. In December, I spoke with Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's a faculty fellow in the Department of Psychology and director of Temple University's Infant Language Laboratory. I started out by asking her about one of her areas of expertise, the magic and science of vocabulary and grammar development.
A lot of times we think that it's all about just dumping words into the empty mind of a child. And so we think it's something like learning our SAT or GRE words. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. We learn vocabulary while we're learning to talk, while we're having conversations. And the most important thing we can do is have conversations with our children, with our teachers. If we have more discussion, our children learn more. And unfortunately, today, many of those conversations are lacking. They're lacking because we're each on our separate little cell phone devices, or we're in a classroom and we're being taught at rather than being taught with, which is not the way in which we learn. So we got to step it up. We got to languageize our environments and languageize our schools. That means having more conversations and not just drilling in words.
You mentioned phones and tablets and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel about apps that are aimed at children's language learning?
Well, you know, I'm all for technology if it's the right technology. But I think in many cases we overdo. And what we do is we see that our kids like it, and we go, wow, we're going to let our kids do whatever they want because they
love it. This is an easy fix for the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, it is easy, you know? We pass over the phone. They're quiet at the restaurant. I mean, really? Not bad. Good babysitter. At the same time, we don't feel the same way about just serving people dessert. They like that, too. And I got to tell you, I would pick chocolate cake over green beans any day. But you're not going to let me eat chocolate cake all day. So everything has to be in balance. What makes a good app? I'm just going to give you a tweet for it. When it's something that allow our children to be active rather than passive, engaged rather than distractive, when it's meaningful rather than disjointed, when it's socially interactive, it prompts people to have those conversations. And it has a kind of goal to it. But those apps that just kind of scream at you, nix. And they're certainly not educational.
Television has been in the conversation for years.
Right.
What about using a television or television shows to help children learn?
Well, I think, again, and it's the same thing we learned in the research on television shows, we find that parents don't hang around a co-view, which is what allows us to have those conversations. So that kind of doesn't work. And some shows are better than other shows. So you have shows that are out there that are absolutely fabulous.
Like a Sesame Street?
Sesame Street is a known quantity. The Blue's Clues, the Tumbleleaf. There are a lot of fabulous shows out there. Watch the good ones. How do you know whether they're good ones or not? Common Sense Media puts out a lovely guide. And if you look there, you'll know what apps are largely the best apps, and you'll also get a sense of what are the best shows.
What are some of the common myths and misunderstandings that we grew up with but have since been disproven by science?
I think the biggest misunderstanding is that we should be CEOs and that our kids are there to just take in everything we teach them. Really, it's more of a back and forth. Children learn when they're active learners. Brains grow when children are active explorers and discoverers. They are very far from empty vessels. So the very best advice that we give as psychologists and scientists is to help those brains grow by having those conversations and allowing our kids to be the explorers and discoverers that they are.
Is there evidence to show whether a bilingual household is more beneficial to language learning or not?
There's a lot of evidence out there. And the answer is that being bilingual is a real plus. In fact, it's almost a shame that we aren't all bilingual. We should be. Having two languages has wonderful payoffs for us. Among them is that we have better executive function skills, which is attention and memory, problem solving, flexibility of mind. We have better self-control because you have to learn to inhibit one language while you're using the other language. Now, children who are growing up in a bilingual home, they generally will have their first words just a very pinch later and maybe put words together a pinch later, but the advantages far outweigh any of the negatives. Plus, a big plus, you're less likely to have Alzheimer's when you grow up.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
One language helps you learn the other language, your own language, sometimes your native language. You learn better when you learn another language.
Well, I think we are just wonderful at learning languages. One of my colleagues says that humans learn language in the way that spiders spin webs. Isn't it beautiful? And we really do. And we know that a lot of children can learn 2 and 3 and 4. The majority of the world is at least bilingual. So it's just putting the machinery, you know, into high drive, and it does a great job in high drive.
Why does it get so much more difficult as you get older?
The brain has certain critical periods. It's not a close-off, but it means that it's more sensitive to certain information at certain points in time. And language is one of the golden cases for the critical period or sensitive period hypothesis. It turns out that after around age 8, if you move to another country, you'll still have an accent. And the younger, the better for being exposed to those multiple languages. One more point on that, which is, what's the best way to help groom a bilingual child? One parent speaks one language, the other parent speaks the other, or in-home language, out-of-home language. Try not to mix it up too much from the same parent, because if you do that, you kind of get it all together.
A lot of mashing it up, right?
Yeah.
What is the cutting edge of language science? What's the unanswered question that you and your colleagues are working on now?
There are so many unanswered questions, to be honest. How is it that this synchrony between mom and kid helps us to learn words? Is there something going on where we kind of share a moment in our brains when we are doing this back and forth language dance? Actually, a lot of people think that's exactly what's going on, and that there's then going to be a sweet spot for how you learn words and how you learn language. What about bilingualism? How's it working? Are those two languages kept separate, or are those two languages somehow closely harbored in the same mental house? We're starting to get information on that. We don't absolutely know. We know a lot about language development. Can we use it? Can we help apply these lessons to children who are not typically developing and help each of them raise the potential? Right here at the Mind Institute, you have researchers who have broken through to show us that children who are born with autism can be in the normal curve in their language development. All children, some 90%, will get there if we have the right kind of early interventions. And the science teaches us what those early interventions are. So your homegrown work is part of the frontiers of the science that we're creating every day.
There's also science to show, is there not, that when you're thinking in a different language, mm-hmm. you interact with the world differently. You think about problem solving differently. Like it's not just saying different words. It's a whole different way of thinking.
There's a yes and a no to that. It's not as if I can't communicate perfectly well with somebody from France or someone from China and get them to understand what's in my head. So in that sense, all human minds share a way of communicating and a way of thinking and a way of representing. On the other hand, it is absolutely the case that different languages highlight different things. So let's take probably the two most prominent languages around here, which would be Spanish and English.
Right.
In the Spanish verb system, and I bet you very few people know this, you're more likely to talk about the path, where you're going, than about how you're moving. That's what gets coded into the verb system. into, alongside. We talk about the path at which someone is going. Now, in English, we have 22 times more what we call manner verbs, or how you're moving, jumping, that you're running, that you're skipping, that you're hopping. So in Spanish, the English equivalent would be something like, I'm moving into the house hoppingly. Whereas in English, we say, I'm hopping, and put the into outside the verb in a preposition, into the house. Now, who notices that? But it turns out that our kids do. And it turns out that when they are hearing Spanish and English, they're primed just a little bit more to look at the path, where it's going in Spanish, and to the manner, how you're moving in English.
That was Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek speaking with me last December. She's faculty fellow in the Department of Psychology and director of Temple University's Infant Language Laboratory. We have more on our website. It's capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. This is Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. It's that time of year. The Tiny Desk Sacramento Showcase is just around the corner. Hey Listen host Nick Bruner curated a list of local highlights from the contest with help from musician Lillian Francis and producer Camille Escovedo in anticipation of Cap Radio's musical celebration coming up on June 1st.
Tiny Desk contest time has quickly become my favorite part of the year. That's Christmas and Fun Drive all rolled up into one.
It was like getting to knock over a treasure chest and just pick up all these individual jewels and kind of look at the way that they shine in the light.
I had so much fun. I would start at like 10 p.m. and then all of a sudden it would be midnight. And I was like, Lillian, you have to respect your bedtime. Go to sleep.
Lillian, let's start with your contributions first. You had five really, really strong contenders here. Tell me about the Sean Thwaites Quartet and Camilla.
Normally it takes me a couple listens to really hear the melody of a song, but this one I gravitated towards right away. And I loved Camilla's vocals. She could sing the dictionary and I would be pleased. And then the keys and the steel drum in the background just make it the most lush composition.
The moon flirts with me as I write so sweet like the smell of rain. I couldn't say I'm sorry for missing your call again. Drooling on my sheets while I go to sleep so late again. I lost my keys, I cannot be late again, oh.
I talked to Camilla, and she said that Moon was written as an ode to my self-awareness and a representation of my commitment to personal improvement. And I love that. And I also see the full moon as a time of reflection. Every time it comes back to think about the last month and kind of how things have changed since then. So I love that she's also using the moon as this reminder to be good to oneself. To the playful moon.
It sounds like a rose, like the flourishing of oneself. Quietly blooming, just taking care of yourself, doing really mundane things, but just how lovely that can be in your own company.
Real good pick, Lillian, for starters. Let's move into a musician called C. Loud. Tell me about him.
Oh man, I love this performance. Chris Lau, that's his name, draws inspiration from his own experiences as a teacher of transgender teens and from his struggles growing up gay in a conservative Catholic family. It's like a 7-minute song, and this dude is just slaying bar after bar. He's a really vivid storyteller, and I was just trying to keep up.
Headstrong dad Claude had more in common with his sisters and mom than his brothers never wanted to go play. He'd hear his bros say, God, Claude's so gay, which they said cause instead of saying yo, he'd go hey, and he liked to crochet. Comparing him to his brothers was like a pig to a pugger, apples to OJ. It made him sad at night that his family only saw in black and white like a domino game. No, there was no gray. His dad would hope and pray it was just a phase, but it didn't go away. He raised his sons as men the macho way, but unlike them, trap shooting and fishing, he was cooking food in the kitchen and more into knitting mittens like it was snow day.
That track just got more and more potent as I listened to it. Just it builds and builds and builds and just tells this incredibly moving story.
It's really beautiful, and I love the message. And it's a good segue into the winner this year, who wrote about his experience being transgender and being accepted and not wanting to be erased. It's inspiring. It's a moving song.
The lyrics make me definitely want to print it out and just analyze it bar by bar. And I think it's really important as well that this song exists, particularly in the social climate of today, that songs like this exist that breathe life into how technicolor gender is and giving life to different forms of masculinity as well.
Another very personal portrayal coming from Trey Burt. Lillian, tell me more about this track, Everybody's Mother.
Trey has such a worn timelessness to his voice. Listening to his songs feels like putting on like your grandfather's jacket. It's just like comfortable and old, and you just want to like keep it on. This song is about trying to squash the patriarchy, and he says that he gets inspiration from strong women in his life and seeing what they've had to go through.
Skin is dark as the ocean. It turns blue moonlight. She'll pick the moment when you least expect it. Hide it in plain sight. And you'll never see her coming. Yes, she takes you.
I love his songwriting, and I love listening to him play guitar. It's never boring. I feel like Trey has a brain that's constantly going and constantly writing, and so I like getting a little glimpse into the things he's thinking.
Every word is so poetic, and it just, to me, is like starlight. I really, really appreciate and love his poetry, as well as like a solemn ode to the ferocity of women, what they've gone through, and what's coming to the fore right now. I get chills when I listen to it.
Moving on, Lillian, tell me about Some Dude. S-U-M-D-O-O-D.
This song is just straight up fun. When I talked to Some Dude about this, he said that he felt most uninhibited in this song and that it wasn't written to have a narrative, statement, or purpose other than to be simply fun and unusual. As a songwriter myself, sometimes we get in our heads and things have to mean something, and you can't just shut up your brain and just channel the forces that be to create music. And it's kind of a hard task, actually, to just create a song that's for fun. But I love it, and I think he did a great job. It's catchy. It is no more and no less than a little pop gen needs.
I think that it's very colorful, and it just feels like creativity is just fizzing over in it, and it's just a wonderful little soda drink.
All right, Lillian, and the final entry of your top five picks of this year's Tiny Desk contestants is a group called Water Bear with a song about, well, the water bear.
This is a super interesting, unique song. I don't think I've ever heard anything like it. I don't think everybody is ready for Water Bear, but the more I listened to it, the more it got stuck in my head, and now I, like, you know, I sing the chorus, and as I keep listening to it, you know, eventually I'll be able to like sing the verses as well. It's a super tidy but complex song. Steven, the pianist and singer, says that the song suggests vastness in the microscopic realm. And I totally feel that. It's just a treat. It's so funny.
To a mountain on the hair of a leg of a tiny gnat.
So if Brian Eno were to go on Sacramento cable access television, I think we would have something akin to Water Bear. It took me a couple listens, but like I remember coming back to it again and again and again and again, just for how playfully bizarre it is, but also catchy and informative, as it turns out. This is actually a science lesson about the Water Bear.
I liked how it glorifies this really, really tiny microscopic thing that's kind of cute, but it's also kind of nasty. Like, it's a freaking weird creature.
I also will note that Steven says that Water Bear is a pretty simple song compared to most of their music. I gotta dive in. I want to see what, if this is their simple stuff, I would love to see their complex stuff.
If you are my microscope lens, it's a moss, and you might find one down. The water bear has all the comforts of life within his tiny lab.
Camille, let's move on to your picks. Tell me about Casey Smith and why you chose her track.
I loved it because, like, it reminds me of ripples across, like, a dark pond, and a really deep pond, and so it just, like, pulls you in. It's really sad, but there is this glimmer of hope, however deep down it pulls one to the bottom.
They don't mind if I come around, but I feel like I'm already gone. I'm already gone. I already lived to every song.
There's never a part that's like, this part didn't have to be in here. It's very paced out.
And it's a simple song, but I don't know. She manages to keep my attention the entire time. I think if you're a fan of a musician like Sharon Van Etten, you'll definitely want to check out more from Casey Smith. But Lillian, what did you think?
Yeah, this is another hypnotic one. And I really like the idea of like that feeling of being somewhere, but knowing that you're totally checked out and kind of wanting to catch up with yourself.
Camille, next on the list, we have a family band, a family funk band, in fact. This is Latour. Tell me about them.
Well, first of all, it's cute because it's a family and there's a little dog in the video and stuff. And so I was already like, okay, I was ready for like a lighthearted adventure. And then the music begins and it just swells into this very balmy, like very uplifting kind of romantic sound.
Everything about this group makes me smile in a big way. So let's hear their cut from this year's contest.
This bass line, though.
Tatiana smiling kind of through the lyrics, and it just makes me think of sunshine working its magic. It's cute.
Unpopular opinions with Lillian, I normally don't like funk music, and I love this song. The melody is just so breezy. I'm down.
Good pick, Camille.
Thanks.
Next up is Hannah Mae Reid. Another guest of Cap Radio's in the past. Tell me more about why you chose her piece.
I love a good odyssey, and Hannah Marie crafts it, and it's just them and their guitar. And yet they create this whole, like, spellbinding experience. There's a part where they're whistling, and it's very strange but beautiful, but also very alien-like. And I feel like that really captures how self-growth actually is. And that's what I got out of the song.
I touch away, found it on eyes, trying to rise. The forces of my mind is bothered on material things. My body not in vain, I just feel pain as in the rain.
Have so much emotion in their voice. It's definitely a voice that tells a lot of stories. And I love when they hit those high notes. They sound so good.
So that's Hannah Mae Rhee. Moving on to Space Walker.
April Walker is super dynamic and gives an amazingly dazzling performance. She records harmonies and then loops them, so it sounds like she's awakening harmonies and beats out of thin air.
I was building a sculpture. That's why my hands are turning. I've been circling about vultures. My master plan is a worthy. You've been pretty good at raising vibes, director. You've been pretty good at saving lives, resurrector. When you speak to someone and you know they lied, do you correct them? What do you accept, huh? What do you expect, Walker Giants again!
I'm a huge fan of Toon Yards, and I think that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to Space Walker's music when I first found out about it, because it's so much fun to watch April build her song, like in real time.
And I'm super jealous because I hear it and I'm like, I want to go where she goes, but I don't know how. Like, I think she's the only one.
Just trying to move.
So we hear from Space Walker, who I think could be pretty aptly described as a one-person band, into Michael Turgeon, who I think also has some of those same qualities in the piece that you wrote about next.
I really love that the song accumulates peacefulness over time, but it also, there's these keyboard chords that suddenly drive the song into very alarming, like, presentness, and then it, like, steps back into this, like, softness again. Yeah, it's my favorite song in the whole contest.
The sun came up and I packed my tent and I returned to the promised land. I know I always write my best songs with a thin meal in my
Don't you just picture a deer, like, skittering across the sky?
Well put.
It feels very soundtracky. It inspires a lot of calmness and optimism and nostalgia all at the same time.
That's Michael Turgeon with The Great Unconformity. We're running down our favorite entrants from NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest for 2019. I'm Nick Bruner, in with Camille Escobedo and Lillian Francis. Can I introduce the two of you to The Vat?
What's that?
The Vat's my very first pick for my top five here, and this is a new group fronted by Greg Brown, who has been making music in and around Sacramento since the early 90s. In fact, he was the original guitarist for Cake. He's responsible for the song The Distance. I didn't know that until I started asking him questions about his band, which is still relatively new. In fact, this is the only song, as of this recording, that's online. This track currently is called Stay Away.
You better stay away for a while. You better let her cool down. Let her cool down, all right. Do you know what time it is? You gotta give a person space. She doesn't wanna see your face. She's been seeing it all over the place. Because it comes and it goes,
and it ebbs and it flows,
and you're losing control,
and it's starting to show
all the cracks in the street,
all the lies in the sea.
You should turn around, but man, you're in too deep. So stay away for a while. Better let her cool down. Let her cool, cool down, alright.
So I get a real nostalgic kick out of this song. I mean, it's incredibly contemporary, but it reminds me of when I was in high school listening to bands like Cake, for obvious reasons, but also groups like the Dandy Warhols and Blur, and I think, Lillian, you were saying it kind of smacks of Broken Bells for you. Camille, what'd you think of that?
I found it very motivational. Mm-hmm. Like, it definitely made me want to get a sweatband on and then have a training montage for something.
I was wondering why you were doing burpees, so I guess that may all make sense now. I am pleased to also let you both know that that is going to be on the bill for this year's Tiny Desk Sacramento show.
Yeah.
Well, something a little more cooled off than the track we just heard comes from the Midnight Dip. And this is a band out of Davis. They are a five-piece fronted by a woman named Liz Catt. And she tells me that they've been making music only for about a year. But what I love about it is it's so operatic and it's so colorful. The track that they submitted for the contest this year is called Dollhouse.
Sitting in the sauce for myself, with nothing but plastic to compound. Waiting for the world to let me out. I'm learning when I come up with a how. A moment in the color and just chain. I'm not sure what I can explain. My world goes to pink and black and blue. I need to hear a voice so I get through. Oh,
oh. Creepy as hell.
Really? You think it's creepy?
No, but in the best way. In like a Tim Burton, like that's exactly what it is for me.
I got a distinct Tim Burton vibe off of it just from the jump. And especially when those bells come into play and just the kind of like swaying cabaret nature of it. And the way Liz Catt just wails. I wasn't expecting that.
I really agree with that of how elusive the song is at first. Like, you're like, there's something going on. It's super, it starts off really intriguing, and then you're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
The Midnight Dip will also be joining us for Tiny Desk Sacramento 2019. They'll be opening the show here at Cap Radio on June the 1st. Another surprise that I found early on was from Igwe Aka. He was born in Nigeria. He moved to Citrus Heights when he was a kid. I think it was around fifth grade that he started going to school here. He has this track out called One Wish that immediately gets my attention, but man, once his vocals kick in, I just forget it. I'm hooked for the rest of the song.
Waking up on blue moons with a border on my back. Gotta have blue moves at my head on my lap. In way too many dreams and they vivid as they seem. I think I just might be dying trying for a scene. And I live it in replay every day. And it's vivid in replay every day. And I live it in replay every day. And it's vivid in replay every day. So if I hand you my weed, break it down and roll it up for me. Is it what it seems when we in this company? Hand you my weed.
I described it as the vocal equivalent of never breaking eye contact. Like, there's just this intensity that he's just like, it's just got me.
That's such a great comparison. I love how the piano and his vocals kind of twirl around each other back and forth throughout the whole thing, and it really reminds me of him capturing kind of the dreamiest parts of a regular day.
So much swag.
Absolutely. That guy's got confidence just to spare.
Yeah.
Awesome. Next band I wrote about is called House of Mary. Another group that does an awful lot with a guitar, one drum, two vocalists. Let's have a listen.
How the drum sounded kind of like someone tapping their foot increasingly impatiently. And so I really like that there's something has to change or something has to give.
Ooh, now that you've mentioned it, it kind of gives the track an insistence like, hey, hey,
Yeah, and when she says move along, it's kind of like, okay, let's go.
Moving
along.
Okay, very nice. Finally on my list, the headliner for the Tiny Desk Sacramento show. The group is A Tribe Quartet out of Sacramento. He says when he composed this song, it was after hearing about the death of Stephon Clark in his own neighborhood.
What's not to love about this? It's so good.
I think that's our roundup for 2019. Lillian Francis and Camille Escovedo, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Franny Pack out.
That was Nick Bruner, Lillian Francis, and Camille Escovedo with their picks from the 5th Tiny Desk Concert. Tiny Desk Sacramento will happen on June 1st. You can see a few of those artists perform live here at Cap Radio. Tickets, we're told, going fast. You can find all of the details at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for this week. You know, today is producer Bert Johnson's last show, and we are really going to miss him. But you'll be hearing from him soon. Starting in June, he'll be covering Northern Nevada for us. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Technical director is Mark Jones. Senior producer is Helen Barrington. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And we'll be back on Tuesday. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us.
Taste the wealth, right? Ain't gonna happen overnight. I'm doing my cardio, keeping it tight, cooking it up, feeding my body right. And I'm brushing and flossing for kissing goodnight.